langoustine,
pineapple, sweet potato,
papaya, parsley, peach.
You can see all 55 on TexasSuperfood.com.
Raspberry, spinach, all of the nutrients that we need on a daily basis.
You know, it's been barely a week, and already my skin is better.
I lost 60 pounds. I mean, that's huge.
Since I've been on Superfood, I haven't been sick.
I'm Dennis Black here in Dallas, Texas. Wouldn't you rather be healthy, energetic, and fit?
It's borderline shocking how much energy I have.
Join us on TexasSuperfood.com.
TexasSuperfood.com.
Or call 877-55-TEXAS. That's 877-55-TEXAS. 877-55-TEXAS. Or
TexasSuperfood.com.
And now, Maine's best guest list, live from Bangor, this is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
That is absolutely true. Welcome in to the second hour of the program. On a Tuesday afternoon, Rich Kimball and Carrie Haskell here with you. Downtown's second hour is brought to you by Slipping Gears Cycling. They're located at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, the area's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook for updates. You can shop in person or online at slippinggears.com. Downtown also presented by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. And guests of the program are heard on the G&M Family Market phone line. G&M on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden, open 7 days a week from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. Coming up in this hour of the program, Dennis Price with an entertainment report, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Joe Carr looks back 25 years ago tonight. Maine hockey won the national championship. Joe was on the mic for that call and will take us back in time and share some memories with us. But we get things rolling like we do every Tuesday afternoon by welcoming back to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
Well, my goodness, what's up is you and your writing taking you to Harper's with a terrific short story entitled Find the Edges. And before we talk about that, I want to blow some sunshine up your kilt here. And, man, not everybody gets their fiction published in Harper's. This is a big time.
Yeah, well, the numbers are certainly against you, even if you have a lot of people working on your behalf. And I essentially have an industry against me, so that's certainly not the case. But Harper's has been around since 1850. And if you're a subscriber, you get the whole backlog of everything, and you can read Nathaniel Hawthorne in their pages and Mark Twain and Herman Melville. So yeah, it's been around about as long as anything literary wise in this country.
Well, and the story itself is absolutely terrific. And let's start with the very title, Find the Edges, which has multiple meanings in your story.
So the story is basically there is a man, and he has two boys, and he doesn't have a wife anymore because she has died. And we don't find out exactly why she died. And I think when we experience pain, it's not really the specificity of it that matters so much as that kind of all-subsuming totality that covers up some of the specifics. So the story is a miasma of pain in many ways, and he's trying to go along with his life after his wife is gone with these two kids, Case and Danny. And Danny has had some problems at school where he has been previously molested by a teacher, and he has a kind of residual guilt for this, as though he was complicit in it. And he's basically asking kids to beat him up, to just beat the snot out of him. And what ends up happening at one point is the father goes to the school and has at the teacher. And this is all before kind of the death of his wife. And these kids are at the age where they're drifting away in a little bit, and they've lost their mother. And the notion of a pain so overwhelming that we can't even kind of see where it begins and where it ends. And I think that's where the title comes from. You sort of start looking outward from this miasma to go as far as you can to find the furthest Lewis and Clark type points of that pain, that thing that's overwhelming your life. And once you get to that edge, as bleak as it is, you find it, you can start working your way back inwards to find yourself again, to find your loved ones again, your ability to love and your ability to move forward in life.
This story, Colin, is something that had been percolating for a while. It was based on an idea you had quite a while ago and put aside until, well, obviously was the right time.
Yeah, there was a story I had called Send Me Your Pillow, and it was really long, and I wrote it over a bunch of years, and it's the last story in the book I did called Between Cloud and Horizon. And it was about this man, youngish man, who watches his father die in the hospital with his mother there as well. And he kind of becomes haunted by the imagery, because the hospital's a lot like a haunted house. If you've been in like an ICU, you hear those noises and the wheezing and the machines and things that you can't put names to in terms of what's producing that sound. And he's haunted by these nightmares. And he has this old neighbor across the street, elderly, and she goes down to get the mail every day. And one day he sees her fall. She's motionless, and he calls the ambulance. And he's sort of like an ambulance chaser, but in a really controlled, disturbed way, where he goes to the hospital and he poses as someone who knows this woman intimately. She doesn't have any family. And he's waiting to watch her die so he can essentially have this new imagery replace what's been haunting him. So I did that story, and then afterwards I thought about how when people die, and I've lost my dad and my sister, people come by and they leave food at your house, right? Like, they come by a lot, and sometimes it can almost be like, oh my goodness, are they coming again? Or when's this going to run out? Are they just going to come indefinitely? So I just jotted some notes down about that on a piece of paper, put it in a pile, and then years later, I had a nightmare one night, most of this story came to me, and I pulled out that fragment, and I just built it from there, and I wrote the entire story in about half hour. It's only 2,000 words long.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. His new story, Find the Edges, is in this month's Harper's. You approach fiction, at least this particular work of fiction, a little differently than folks who tend to write about, well, slightly fictionalized versions of their own life, but this one sprung entirely from your mind.
This story was turned down by about 100 literary magazines that don't pay or pay very little, with a circulation of 500 or so that specialize in publishing MFA writers who do stories that couldn't actually mean anything to lives, in which they just fictionalize their very sort of tepid existences. These aren't people who are going a whaling out of New Bedford and they're going to write colorfully about that. It's usually elitist people who come from money, who look after each other. So that's how you end up with a story that can be in Harper's that literally no one else would publish, which is crazy. People don't know that that's how publishing really works. It's a cesspool of cronyism. And it's almost like what I do with the nonfiction. Like, it confuses some people. They're like, oh, how are you hockey guy and Beatles guy and jazz guy and fiction guy? It's actually the exact same thing. I tell a story every single time I sit down to write something. Just the proper nouns change. So you write the Beatles thing, so someone who has no interest in the Beatles whatsoever is going to connect with it, because it's not really about the Beatles. It's about the ideas that you are bringing in front of their eyeball. Same with a story like this. People just put a label on it, but I've not been a father. I haven't lost a wife in a death sense. And that's very strange. You don't see a lot of that these days, where people are just relying on imagination. Everyone wants to be a writer. Everyone goes to get an MFA. And when you get an MFA, you're imitating forms of stories that are easily replicated. If you were Dickens and you were writing A Christmas Carol, you couldn't be in that program because you'd be bounced out of workshop because people can't imitate you. You have an ability. And I think the best writers, the best artists always, they go to places well beyond the whole write what you know thing. It's invent what you can conceive of and bring that to people.
I want to read just a little snippet here of Find the Edges. And this is after Ted and his wife have a little argument that crops up. And he says, you're supposed to let these things go. But he was always too anxious, too eager, wanting to improve things. He wanted to be a better parent. His wife was the one the boys came to. His duties lay elsewhere as far as they were concerned. Ice cream man. He took them for treats after his wife had done the fixing up. His job was to pretend that this trip to the Dairy Queen represented a new start. Now things would get better. Half a puzzle had been assembled on his watch, but mostly thanks to his wife's love and counsel. I mean, this is what's so poignant to me about this. This is a dad trying to find his way, and the irony is that he sort of has to lose his wife to find his role in this family.
There's this moment with the boys where they are talking down the hall, and the dad is in his bed, and he can hear them, but he can't make out what they're saying. And he hears like their little feet shuffling off to the bathroom. And again, it's this kind of haunted ghost-like quality in a story that where there are no actual, like, not an E.F. Benson story, it's not a Henry James story, but there's this moment of kind of this ghostness and lost souls and this father trying to find himself and to be a kind of joint parent at the same time. And I should say that the editor of this story, James Marcus, I've given him like bunches of stories in the past and he's wanted to publish some, and that was before he became the editor-in-chief, and things kind of got gummed up, and I never know what he's going to like out of like a passel of like four or five stories. But when he picks something, I find that out of the editors I've had, he does just this amazing job of a kind of like control, but also like a sparse control where something might be scaled back, or he'll just sort of put a challenge out there. And I think kind of there's this crucial moment the story hinges on. And I wrote it, but James prompted me to write it simply by writing in the margins, you need something big here. And it's near the end where everything's kind of played out and you don't know how it's going to resolve, though. Is he basically going to get his kids back in a sense, even though he hasn't lost them? And it goes, alone again, he drove to the school where he had beaten the teacher and sat in his car, looking at the window of the classroom where he used to think his boy had been lost to him. He remembered how his wife would usher him to come to some event at the school and how proud she would look when she gazed upon her children doing one of those meaningless things, picking something up off the ground, winking at one of their friends, forgetting to cover their mouths when they coughed, getting it right the next time. When she gazed at him, it was a different look. He didn't wish to call it warmer. That would be wrong. It was a look of confluence. Not mine, not yours, ours. And that whole last bit about not mine, not yours, not ours, that was all just from James saying, you need something big here. This is a big moment. And it takes it into that final kind of coda, which a lot of people seem to think, because the story has quite a bit of pain in it, that it must have to have a negative ending. But I feel like it doesn't at all. I feel like it's very optimistic at the end, that these people are going to have a hard time for a while. They're real enough that you believe they are out there, so you're rooting for them. But you also get the sense that in however long it takes, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, they're all going to be okay. Or they could be. Even the dad, who in some ways has the heaviest burdens being the solo parent now.
Yeah, that scene is an absolute gut punch. But I love the fact that he's able to learn, in some ways, learn what parenting is about from the neighbors, the Rendons, these, in many ways, surrogate parents.
The Rendons are these people who are dropping off the dinners. And one of them, the Mr. Rendon, he thinks he's like this Charles Atlas guy, like this weekend warrior person, the guy you come out and like you hose off like patio furniture, and this ripped guy across the street who's like middle-aged is doing push-ups in the driveway. He's that guy. And you learn things about these Rendons, though, that you kind of speaks to how we draw conclusions too easily about people, and maybe they have a greater capacity to impact our lives in really amazing ways than we think at first. And what happens near the end is they show up in their car with the boys, and they don't intrude upon this guy, but they let the kids get out of the car, and they wait in their car, and the boys go in with their dad, and they have this, well, as you said, this kind of gut punch sort of moment. But yeah, the Rendons are absolutely crucial to the story. And I think, too, that when we consider death, and if you've lost someone really close to you, you know this, your relationship with them changes. It doesn't end. It continues on if you allow it to. It doesn't mean like they're coming down and hovering over you, but that's what's happening with this guy's wife. And he's realizing that sort of through his kids.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that, too, because I think that relationship with the person who's no longer there can go either way, and you can, and a lot of times it happens, you can blame them, you can be angry with them for not being there, for not sharing the load of parenting in this case, although a lot of that was done beforehand, but that's not how this relationship appears to be changing. A hopeful one, one of optimism, and even some equality seems to be emerging from this.
Yeah, and a one of blessing, too, really, of that kind of confluence. I mean, I felt it when my dad died. I was only 25 years old, and he was 53. And I found that as I went along in life, as I go along in life now, as I do my crazy, like, 20-mile walks where I write stories like this one in my head, that our relationship has just changed. It's not, like, ideal. You want that person around for the duration of the time you feel like you have coming with each other. But love, when it's real, it really doesn't kind of have edges, I guess. And he's also finding that. He's finding that certain things in life are edgeless, including, you know, really good things, too, that countervail, to some degree, his pain.
Well, it's a tremendous story. It's worth, for this alone, buying the April edition of Harper's Find the Edges by Colin Fleming. Make sure you get a copy of it and read it. Wonderful, wonderful work, Colin. As always, great to talk with you about it.
Thank you.
All right, we'll see you next time. Colin Fleming, every Tuesday on Downtown. It's 19 minutes after 5 o'clock. Rich Kimball, Carrie Haskell here. Just ahead, we talk entertainment. Our friend Dennis Price, Joe